this is important to recognize, that it's not just the climate system we need to pay attention to, but all of those valuable assets that we have out there, from all the way from agricultural systems to groundwater systems to the trillions of dollars of infrastructure that we have along the coastlines. These are things that a slowly changing system can push them over the edge.
Last week, scientists in the National Academy of Sciences released a new report called Abrupt Impacts of Climate Change, Avoiding Surprises, focusing on the abrupt changes that can occur in a matter of years or decades as opposed to centuries or more. Today I'll be talking to Jim White, Professor of Geological Sciences and Environmental Studies at the University of Colorado in Boulder, who chaired the committee that wrote the report. Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. Last Friday, CommonDreams.org posted a piece with a headline, 12 Mandela Quotes That Won't Be in the Corporate Media Obituaries, on sanitizing the legacy of anti-apartheid leader Nelson Mandela. The first Mandela quote listed, wait for it, "A critical, independent, and investigative press is the lifeblood of any democracy. The press must be free from state interference. It must have the economic strength to stand up to the blandishments of government officials. It must have sufficient independence from vested interests to be bold and inquiring without fear or favor. It must enjoy the protection of the Constitution so that it can protect our rights as citizens." Now that is something to think about. I think I'll think about it right now, and maybe read it again later in the show. And speaking of Mandela, I had Danny Schechter, the news dissector, on a couple of weeks ago, and he mentioned his new book then about to come out, Mandiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. Well, the book is out, and I'm reading it, and Danny Schechter will return to Tell Somebody next week to talk with me about it. Another programming note, the following week, on December 26, the day after Christmas, Ray McGovern returns to Tell Somebody to take a look back at 2013 with us. You may have heard Ray yesterday on alternative radio on KKFI. AR broadcasted a speech he gave in Seattle recently about whistleblowing. Somewhere in that talk, Ray mentioned an admonition from someone about a NOAA rule, the idea that we don't need more weather forecasters, we need more ark builders. Well, my next guest chaired a committee advocating an early warning system that could be considered a forecasting system that would be a stimulus for some metaphorical ark building. Now, how's that for a tortured segue? Reading now a press release from the National Academies, December 3, 2013, for immediate release. New report calls for attention to abrupt impacts from climate change, emphasizes need for early warning system. The study was sponsored by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, National Science Foundation, U.S. intelligence community, and the national academies. The National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineering, Institute of Medicine, and National Research Council make up the national academies. They are private, independent, nonprofit institutions that provide science, technology, and health policy advice under a congressional charter granted to the NAS in 1863. The Research Council is the principal operating agency of the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering. Dr. James W.C. White is a professor of geological sciences and of environmental studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he is also a fellow at the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research, or INSTAR, and past director of the Environmental Studies Program, and he is the chair of the committee that wrote the report, Abrupt Impacts of Climate Change, Anticipating Surprises. Jim White, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Appreciate you taking the time. So, somehow in connection with the National Academy of Science and other organizations, you chaired a committee that put out a report. Can you first tell us about the National Research Council and the national academies and who else involved in this?
Well, the National Academy of Science is the nation's go-to organization for scientific information. President Lincoln started it back in the 1860s, I believe. But this is where Congress and the president go when they want unbiased scientific information. It pulls in scientists from around the U.S., whether they're members of the Academy or not, and we try to put together the best scientific information we can, the best knowledge we can.
And the report I'm referring to, I actually came across on a commondreams.org article. It's titled, I believe, Abrupt Climate Change, Anticipating Surprises.
That is correct.
Tell us how this committee came about to do this report and what your objectives were.
Well, we were tasked by a number of funding agencies to look at a topic of abrupt climate change. This had first been done back in 2002 in a National Academy report and other reports since then. Both the U.S. and international have looked at the topic. We learned back in the, late 80s that our climate system had thresholds, had what we call tipping points. It was capable of shifting from one mode into another mode, sometimes very large changes, in a very short period of time. I work on ice cores, and frequently in the record of the last 100,000 years, we see changes that are the equivalent of going from Miami to Montreal in less time than it takes to get through college. So these
wow.
days it'd be about 6 years, but that's a pretty remarkable change. And what it says is that as climate changes, we need to know where the sensitive tipping points are. And that's really what we were tasked to do, identify the sensitive points in the climate system, and then discuss the what we could do about it. And we came up with something we call the Abrupt Change Early Warning System.
And I want to hear a lot more about that a little later, but define abrupt climate change for us. I mean, I think you already have a little bit, but
mm-hmm.
you have a formal definition in this report, right?
Yeah, abrupt is generally going to mean years to decades, but we defined it relative to expectation. So, for example, if you expect a system to remain, say, part of the climate system to remain relatively constant over the time period of 10 years, and it changes in 5 years, that's abrupt. Another real-world example is I got a phone call not that long ago from someone who builds air conditioning systems for large computer companies. Computers chew up, make lots of heat, and so they have to buy these rather expensive air conditioning systems. Those systems, the federal government allows them to be written off over 39 years, and he asked a simple question: what was the maximum temperature going to be in 39 years? And I have to say, even though I could feed him an answer, I paused and I said, well, what do you want to know for? And he said, well, if a company like Google wants to buy an air conditioning system, they want it to last for, that 39 years. And if it's obsolete in 15 years because temperatures are rising, then that's a big hit. That's a financial problem. And so in that case, 15 years would be abrupt. But like I said, in general, it's relative to the expectation.
Yes. And maybe you could talk about a couple examples of abrupt climate change. I think there was something in the report about bark beetles. I haven't been to Colorado in a while, but I was out in the Black Hills of western South Dakota last summer, and I was just shocked at all these dead brown trees on the sides of the mountains, just huge areas. Talk about that, maybe another example or two.
Yeah, that would be a good example of an ecological tipping point. So there are a number of pests out there, the bark beetle being one of them, that live where they live because of temperatures. So if temperatures get really cold, bark beetles can't survive the winter. And so they have historically, or at least in our lifetimes, not been found at the high country of Colorado or up in the Black Hills. As temperatures have warmed up, they reached a critical threshold. And in a very short period of time, a matter of a couple of years, pine bark beetles really took over. They were no longer being killed off by cold enough winter temperatures. So that's a threshold. In that case, it's a cold winter threshold where even though, it's kind of hard to say because I know the nation's in the middle of one of the colder cold snaps we've had for a long time. But even that wasn't cold enough to knock back these pine bark beetles. We've seen much colder temperatures back in the 60s and the 50s that used to keep these bugs away. So that's another example. In this case, of an ecological threshold.
And I think it also discussed Arctic sea ice. Can you talk about that just a bit?
Yeah, this is something that we hear about occasionally in the newspaper, but it's really a remarkable change happening in our lifetimes, and it's happening abruptly. Over the last 10 years, sea ice in the summertime in the Arctic has been shrinking very rapidly. It's down now to the point where ships are capable of sailing across the North Pole on a fairly regular basis in the summertime. That has changed a bunch of things. It certainly changes ecosystems up there because now you have blue water. We used to have ice. But it also changes geopolitics. The Russians took a submarine out and planted a flag at the North Pole saying this is ours, and the U.S. doesn't agree with that, but, that's an example of a change that's happening quite abruptly. A way to scale that abruptness, Tom, is it takes about 10 years through the appropriation process and building process, et cetera, to build modern icebreakers. The U.S. has two aging icebreakers that the Coast Guard operates, and the Arctic has been becoming ice-free far faster than we have been able to adapt and build more icebreakers. As a matter of fact, we still haven't really gotten to it and built those icebreakers. And oddly enough, as you have more ice-free conditions in the summertime, you need more icebreakers because you will have more ships up there, and those icebreakers are needed to make sure that the ships are safe.
So that Arctic situation developed a lot sooner than expected. There was some talk at a press conference I saw on the web of what was characterized as good news in the Antarctic, and in some other arenas, like there's been concern about methane being released, and that's the Antarctic ice, and something called the Atlantic Meridional. Meridional, shortened to AMOC. Can you tell me what that is and talk about some of this, in a way, good news?
Yeah. It's important to recognize that, you know, knowledge is a good thing. And in this particular case, we've been studying some tipping points that we thought were problematic. But as we learned more about them, we found out that they're not as troublesome as we thought. And that's not all good news. There are certainly some tipping points, the West Antarctic Ice Sheet being one of them, that we now are more concerned about. And I can loop back to that. But this AMOC thing is just a fancy term for the ocean circulation in the North Atlantic. And what happens there is warm water from the tropics flows north, carries a lot of heat. You know, if your listeners trace their finger across the globe from where England is, you'll find out it's way up in Canada somewhere on our side. It's certainly not that cold in England. And part of the reason for that is there's a lot of heat that's delivered by the ocean up into that area.
Is that the Gulf Stream?
Gulf Stream, indeed. Mm-hmm. And that system can break down because it's driven by water that's cold and salty in the north. It sinks down to the bottom of the ocean, creates a suction, and draws this warm water north. If you have too much fresh water, you don't have enough salt, and if it's not cold enough up there, it doesn't get dense enough and it won't sink. And what we've learned is while that system is likely to fail sometime in the 100-200 year time frame, it's not likely to just give it up abruptly. And that's an important finding. And it shows that, you know, when we have a chance to study these things and collect more information, that in some cases we're going to get good news, and that's a piece of good news.
Yes, and it's good to know that it's not likely to happen soon, but as food for thought, the warming effects of that on England and Northern Europe have had a huge impact on how civilization has developed there for hundreds of years, right?
Absolutely. And like I said, it is a system that we do expect at some point to fail. And there's all sorts of things that will happen when that happens. But like I said, we don't expect that to happen in this century. And that was one of the time frames that we thought was important. Let's take a look at what's happening in this century.
Yeah. And could you talk just a little bit about methane, both mm-hmm. in terms of, do I understand right that it is a much, much worse greenhouse gas in terms of warming than CO2, but the good news is some things we feared aren't likely to happen soon again. Right.
Well, you're absolutely right. Methane is about 20 to 30 times more powerful per molecule as a greenhouse gas than CO2. Here's the basics of that. There's a lot of carbon locked up in soils in the Arctic that are frozen. And there's, matter of fact, there's as much carbon in soils there as there is in all fossil fuels, all coal, oil, and natural gas put together.
Wow.
We know that as the Arctic is warming, and it is indeed warming, that carbon will begin to come out. So it's what's called a positive feedback. As the planet warms up because of more and more greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, nature gets into the act, if you will, and starts to produce greenhouse gases from these frozen soils. Now, we thought for a long time that these systems had the ability to decay rapidly. So over a period of a couple of decades, you'd expect a really large increase of methane to the atmosphere from these systems. What we've learned about them in the little bit of study that we have, and we're always cautionary because we don't know that much about these systems. They're really remote and they're very cold and very hard to work in. We don't think they're going to go really rapidly. We don't think that they're going to just very abruptly release large quantities of methane. There's another source of methane up there, and that's, believe it or not, when organic material in ocean sediments decays, it decays to methane because there's very little oxygen. And methane can be trapped inside of ice crystals to form something called a clathrate or a methane ice. These things are pretty cool. You can pull them up from the sediments, set them on a table, and light it on fire. And what's left when you're done is water, a big puddle of water on the table, and some CO2 that you produced from the flames. These things, they're very abundant, probably much more than all coal, oil, and natural gas. But again, we don't think that these are going to rapidly decay either, because we just don't see the mechanisms. And when you look in the history of the Earth, maybe once, maybe twice in 100 million years do we see evidence that these things might have decayed rapidly. So while, you know, this positive feedback is going to exist and it's going to happen, it isn't going to happen abruptly.
Okay, and let me then echo a question somebody asked at your presentation about a week or so ago. We've got this good news about methane and the North Atlantic and some other things. Is the purpose of this report to kind of damp down concerns generally for global warming and just sort of don't worry, be happy?
Not at all. The reality is that we are producing large quantities of greenhouse gases, and we put them in the atmosphere. CO2 from fossil fuel burning, methane comes from rice cultivation and animals, and nitrous oxide from agriculture. All of these things are changing the energy balance of the atmosphere. So while we point out that there's some good news lurking in here in terms of abrupt changes, I think it's important for everyone to recognize that two things, really. One is there are other tipping points in the system that we are even more concerned about than we were before. And we can talk more about those, but one of those would be the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. The other thing is that one of the things that we called out as a concern is that it's not just a question of the climate system itself hitting thresholds, but even a slowly changing, say, sea level or temperature change can trigger abrupt changes in other systems. A good example of that happened back in New York City when Superstorm Sandy came in. The reality is that there have been many storms that hit New York over the last 100 years, but they didn't quite get to the threshold height of the New York City subway system. Sandy just made it. Sandy, it's a little bit higher. And that was all the difference in the world. So now you've got a flooded subway system. You've got a couple $1 billion worth of damage. So there's a threshold that was breached by a slowly changing system. Now we have a slowly rising sea level. We have a slowly increasing storm coming in. And boom, you got trouble. So this is important to recognize that it's not just the climate system we need to pay attention to, but all of those valuable assets that we have out there, from all the way from agricultural systems to groundwater systems to the trillions of dollars of infrastructure that we have along the coastlines. These are things that a slowly changing system can push them over the edge.
You, a few minutes ago, started to talk about how this report called for an early warning system. Do you want to talk about that some more now?
Yeah, I think that's it's important, I think, for us to get serious about climate change. And you know, whether you're okay with the attribution of human beings or not, the fact is climate is changing. I think we all recognize that. And it's important for us to pay attention to that. It's important for us to be as knowledgeable as we can be. A rising sea level, for example, is going to threaten things like interstates and gas lines and sewage treatment plants and the Norfolk Naval Yard, you know, a very expensive asset that we, the taxpayers, have. We need to do several things. One, we need to watch what's going on out there, and we need to watch it far more carefully than we are now. Second is we need to take those observations and we need to really put them into a modeling framework, a decision-making framework that will allow us to make rational decisions about what to protect. We know we can't protect everything, but it's remarkable that we don't even know what the value of a lot of the infrastructure is, for example, on the coastlines. We don't know, you know, another example is groundwater. We know that that's depleting in many areas. We really haven't done a full economic analysis of how much do we have at stake there in terms of, say, the farming communities that rely on groundwater to ride out droughts. So that's it's important that we watch. The analogy I use is, you know, we have cameras in banks, and we have sophisticated security systems in banks. And those things aren't free. They cost some money. They can be quite expensive, as a matter of fact. But the cost of those things is trivial compared to the value of what's in the bank. So what those systems are watching is worth way more than what the system is, the monitoring system. The same thing is true about the Earth. You know, we depend on our planet for food and for water and air. Ecosystem services is what it's called. It's worth more than the GDP of the whole global economy every year, and we don't watch it enough. We're kind of blind to it. It's like, you know, the most precious bank we have doesn't have enough cameras watching it. So that's step number one. Step number two is to take this information and take from the physical scientists and plug it into what we're learning about how to broadcast these warnings, how to do warnings, and the social scientists are really working on that. A good example are hurricane warnings, which 20 years ago we all saw those cones as the hurricane approached the coast, and the cones were quite big. The cones have shrunk, and that's physical science. But at the same time, we've gotten better at alerting people. We give them fewer false positives. We give them better information about how to handle these issues. And it's important to recognize that over the last decade, not only have we learned more about the planet, but we learned more about how to communicate those issues. So that's really what we're talking about here is an early warning system. And it's there are bits and pieces of it already in the federal agencies and state agencies. But it really it cries out for better coordination, a more efficient system, a system that serves society better than it does. And as I said, the cost of this, you know, while you might, you know, say it's you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but whatever the cost is, it's absolutely trivial compared to that which we're protecting.
This is Tom Clammer, and we're talking to Professor Jim White with the University of Colorado at Boulder about a report issued by a committee he chaired about abrupt climate change. What you were saying kind of raises a lot of issues and personally makes me a little pessimistic at governments and agencies' ability to act within our political systems and do something, but at least we can give them the information they need to act if they would.
Yeah, I think it's important that we try. I mean, that's, you know, I'm not, I share some of your skepticism about the political system today and how broken it seems to be. But at the same time, you know, we're smart. We're smart creatures. And we can do better than that. We can pay more attention to what's going on. You know, I tell people, imagine you're in a dark cave and you have a candle. It's not the best light you can have, you know. But you wouldn't blow it out and throw it aside simply because it wasn't, you know, a fancy LED flashlight. You would use the tools that you have, And maybe that flashlight can help you, that candle can help you find a flashlight. We are in that dark cave when it comes to, you know, our relationship with the planet. We need that candle, and we need that candle to burn so that we can find that flashlight, we can find those big lights, so that we can actually shine some light on this problem, and really deal with these problems in the kind of intelligent way that we're quite capable of.
And it was striking to me that you had a section in the report headline national security or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we think of the laymen like myself think about the pure sciences and ice cores and temperature data and graphs and so forth, but one can pretty easily imagine, say, some country that's got a fair amount of oil and a big army, but they don't have any water. This gets severely exacerbated by climate effects, and a lot of bad things can happen, right?
Well, you're putting your finger on the reason why the number one federal agency that's spending money on climate change is the Pentagon. They know that they're going to have to deal with, you know, your example, which is a good one. There will be refugees as sea level rises, and we've all seen what happens. Countries don't typically open their arms and say, hey, come on in. You know, the Indians aren't going to say to the Bangladeshis, hey, you know, come on in here. There's going to be problems. There's going to be strife. There's going to be suffering. There's going to be, people shooting at each other. And our security systems, from the Army, Navy, Air Force on down to the intelligence systems, they know this. And they, you know, they're quite interested in the kind of information that we're producing as well. Because it's a global economy, Tom, and it's a global world, and like it or not, we're connected.
Yes, and again, I'm a little pessimistic on what people like the Pentagon will do with the information and whether they throw gasoline on the problem or try to put it out, but again, the raw information is important.
I think that's, you know, and you put your finger on a really important point here. As I said in the preface of the report, ignorance is never bliss. I mean, in reality, whistling in the dark is just going to get you in trouble. Nothing hurts. It doesn't hurt to learn more about what's going on out there. Now, how you use that information, we have to be just diligent as can be about that. But collecting that information in the first place is not a problem. It's a matter of fact, it's part of the solution.
And could you talk a little more about your early warning system proposal? How specific does it get? Who would do this?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just a sort of more general idea that something needs to be set up by somebody somehow?
It's really the latter. We knew one of the things that we did as a committee was we took a look at all the previous reports and recognized that many, many times there had been a call for action over the last 10 years, and really not much had happened. The committee felt very strongly that it's time to get serious. It's time to take action. The committee was not composed of enough social scientists and folks like that to really take on the full scope of fleshing out an early warning system. What we laid out were some bones, maybe a bit of the muscle here and there. But really, this is something that's going to have to be tackled by a much more interdisciplinary group of folks, including the social scientists and natural scientists. And also, you know, people who've had experience in this. You know, the folks from the hurricane warning system, the folks from the tornado warning systems, you know, they've learned a lot. We should learn from them.
And the report, have you identified and prioritized some coming abrupt changes that you think we should be particularly concerned about?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. I alluded to a couple of them earlier. One is groundwater. About 10 years ago, we put up a couple of satellites called the GRACE, G-R-A-C-E, they're gravity satellites. as it turns out, the number one reason why gravity changes over the continental U.S. is how much water is beneath your feet. So if there's more groundwater, you weigh more. There's more gravity. So we can actually track groundwater removal, and it's being removed in many parts of the U.S. And in for the folks in Kansas City, you folks are well aware of that issue. But as it turns out, probably the biggest area of concern is the southeast of the U.S. The water tables there are being pumped down quite rapidly. And it rains a lot there, and, that's not something they pay, that's not something that they think is going to be a big problem, let's put it like that. Now, why is groundwater important? Well, groundwater is important because when it comes to food production, when you have a drought, farmers really only have three choices for how to deal with that. One is to take food out of storage, which we don't do anymore. The second is don't farm. Let Brazil do it, which is not an option that I think the American farmer would accept in any way, shape, or form. And the third is to pump water out of the ground. And if the water's not there, or if it's too expensive to pump, then it's a big, big problem. And that can happen abruptly. We saw that with the High Plains Aquifer. We've seen that with other aquifers. Another area of concern is something called the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. So Antarctica, if you look at it, kind of looks like a brain with a stem going off on the West Antarctic side. That West Antarctic side is about 20 feet of sea level rise, potentially. And it's what's called a marine ice sheet. So its base, believe it or not, is hundreds to thousands of feet below sea level. So what's happening today with sea level rise and with warming currents, that ice sheet's being destabilized. And it can shed ice very rapidly. And by very rapidly, I mean it could increase rates of sea level rise that are currently about 3 feet in 100 years. That 3 feet can happen in 30 years. And that is a big difference. So imagine you buy, a beach house or you invest in some property on the coast. You're going to pay a 30-year mortgage on these things. And if at the end of 30 years it's not worth anything because the sea level rise, that is an important hit to you. So just speeding things up by simply a factor of three is a very big deal when it comes to sea level rise. So that's a couple of examples of the kind of things that tipping points that we know are out there in the system that we have to pay attention to.
Yes, and I think a lot of us think that, well, I don't have time to worry about this. The scientists and the government will take care of it, and when it gets really bad, then we can start really doing stuff. But some of those tipping points, you go and take carbon out of the air, it's not going to put the Gulf Stream back where it was.
No, there's a mathematical term for that. It's called hysteresis, where in plain English is you can't get back to where you started. And that's a concern we have, that even if you were to pull greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, could you stop the ice sheets? Could you stop the North Atlantic? And the answer to that is not clear, and in some cases it's pretty clear that these things are more like giant freight trains that once they get going, you really, really can't stop them.
Yeah.
It's also important to recognize that at a time when we ought to be paying more attention to these things, we see cuts in monitoring systems. We see cuts in science that takes that information and digests it and puts it together. The sequestration, for example, today is chipping away at our observation systems, 5 to 7% per year. And if that continues, we're going to find ourselves blowing that candle out in the cave.
Yeah.
One thing I would say is, this abrupt change early warning system this climate early warning system is really, I think we understand the need for that. If you just think about, the way that we run our lives, we have insurance. We know that things that have a low probability of occurring, like one of these tipping points, but have a huge impact, are things that we need to be concerned about. you know, if you go out and drive on the roads of Kansas City, you're likely to hit a little traffic. We all do. But you'll get where you're going. You know, unless there's some drunk driver out there who, you know, slams into you. That's a low probability occurrence, but it's a high impact. And for that, we have insurance. For that, we have airbags. For that, we are willing to pay a lot more for the safety features in an automobile than we did, you know, 30, 40 years ago when there were no seatbelts and, you know, kids were just sitting in the back like I was. We understand, I think, the need to protect ourselves. We understand the need to protect ourselves even for those things that have a low chance of happening. And that's, it all starts with first knowing what the dangers are, and then second, building that system, you know, that insurance system, if you will, so that we have the warnings, or if, you know, if the warning fails, we have a way to deal with the consequences.
Professor White, before I let you go, is there any particular sources of information you'd recommend to our listeners, and any other thoughts you'd like to leave with them?
Well, the National Academy Report is free. It's on the web. You can download the PDF. We did our best in the third chapter to write it in terms of, you know, people using it. Talk about food. We talk about water, things like that. So you can skip through all of the really deep sciencey stuff in chapter two. But I encourage people to take a look at it. It's, like I said, it's free. It's your tax dollars at work. Like I said, I think it's time that we deal with this problem. And we are certainly smart enough and capable enough to do it.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll leave it at that for now. But, Professor White, I really appreciate your time on Tell Somebody. I'll get some of those links up at tellsomebody.us. And maybe we'll talk to you again down the road.
All right. You take care.
Okay. Professor Jim White, chair of the committee that wrote the report, Abrupt Impacts of Climate Change, Anticipating Surprises. More information at www.nationalacademies.org and at www.nap.edu. Coughlin of Nuclear Watch New Mexico was in Kansas City and on the show recently. You can find links to podcasts of two recent shows with him at tellsomebody.us. And while here, he expressed some concern that the federal government might try to walk away from responsibility for a complete cleanup of the Bannister Federal Complex, home of the Honeywell-operated Kansas City Nuclear Weapons Parts Plant. On December 4, 2013, the Kansas City Star reported that the Bannister Federal Complex at Troost Avenue and Bannister Road will be demolished and cleaned up at an estimated cost of $175 million by CenterPoint Properties, who will become the new owner of the site. The $175 million cleanup cost is interesting in that, according to an AP story in 2008, it would cost an estimated $260 million to $300 million to level all the buildings and turn the site into a green field. That does not include cleaning up the subsurface soil and groundwater, which the federal government said in 1989 would cost $460 million. Close quote. Adjusted for inflation, that would probably now have to be well over $1 billion to tear down buildings and clean up the property. So how can they now say that the building will be torn down and the groundwater and soil be cleaned up for only $175 million and the site ready for redevelopment in 2017? A request for an interview with outgoing General Services Administrator Jason Klum went unanswered. The next meeting of the Bannister Federal Complex Community Advisory Panel will be 4:30 to 6 p.m. Thursday, January 9th, 2014. And that will be at the Trailside Center, 9901 Holmes in Kansas City, Missouri. Once again, that will be 4:30 to 6 p.m. Thursday, January 9th. I want to go back now and repeat the quote from Nelson Mandela that I opened the show with. He was quoted as saying, "A critical, independent, and investigative press is the lifeblood of any democracy. The press must be free from state interference. It must have the economic strength to stand up to the blandishments of government officials. It must have sufficient independence from vested interests to be bold and inquiring without fear or favor. It must enjoy the protection of the Constitution so that it can protect our rights as citizens." Are any of you really serious about effecting almost any kind of social or political change? I mean, you actually want to accomplish something? Then you need to think about how the deck is stacked against you via corporate media and illegitimate corporate power, and how they reinforce each other against you. And you need to get involved with a couple of organizations to have any hope of unstacking the deck. KC Move to Amend, www.kcmovetoamend.org, aspires to amend the U.S. Constitution to firmly establish that money is not speech and that only human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. You can also find them on Facebook. Look for KC Move to Amend. The other group is Friends of Community Media, a nonprofit corporation serving the Kansas City area devoted to citizen participation in the media. www.ourfcm.org. That's ourfcm.org. Or look for Friends of Community Media on Facebook. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.